This is Car Expert.
Kia doing it is going to be the kick in the bum that a lot of other car makers need to show that this is the direction the market's going.
I'm not saying we're going to sell the volume of our German competitors, but I think we're going to surprise the public with how many people want to be in that car.
This is something that I've kind of felt with some of Ferrari's latest cars as well, is that they're starting to look a little bit generic.
It's truly, for me, the best medium small premium SUV you can buy right now, still.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I'm joined by Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
And hello to the young James Wong.
Hi, Mandy. Hi, Scott.
I got one of that. You know the that really cool product called GoFar that hooks into your diagnostics port on most modern cars and checks your fuel economy and any problems with the car and all that sort of stuff?
I think I get ads for them on Facebook.
It's an Australian crowd. Anyway, I got one of them for my birthday this year, and I've plugged it into my VW Up. And it's fantastic. But the only thing is I got a notification on the app only yesterday saying, hey, we're just checking in with you. You haven't driven your car in 3 weeks. Is everything okay? Aww,
I love that.
I haven't driven my car in that long and it's really sad.
Have you given your app a name? I know you're a car namer.
Yes, yes. I have called him Carl.
Is it Carl with an exclamation point at the end?
Carl!
No, so I named this little car after the grandpa from the movie Up.
Oh, that's so clever.
Yeah, very good.
So a lot of people are saying, oh, you should have spelt it with a K because it's German. I'm like, no, Carl from the movie Up was spelt with a C, so I went with that, and I've got a little sticker of the Up balloon house on the rear of it. So
I love that so much.
Teeming with a theme there.
I've missed you, Mandy. That's the kind of stuff we used to talk about all the time, silly novel stuff like that. I love it.
We did get a little taste of it this week, though. We got the whole team on Zoom on Tuesday night, which was not quite being in an office, but it was close.
There was, 13 or 14 of us or so, and we did a bit of a trivia night. It was mainly put on for all Victorians because we're all, in stage four lockdown down here. But it was fun. I came second last. I can't believe I just said that. Scully, where did you come?
I'm so glad you asked, Mandy, because I've been practicing my not smug voice. Not sure if it's working because I won. I came first in what can only be described as a real comeback story of a lifetime. Just ran over the top of Costello. Anyway, smug voice is back. And it's great to win. It's a really nice feeling, as it turns out.
So Paul Marek actually put the trivia questions together, and there were four rounds. There was one round that had named the car logo or car badge. And if you want to actually check out all those trivia questions, it's on your social media page. So go and check it out. And, you and your friends can also have a bit of fun as well. Hey, Scully, you were mentioning to me before we press record something about a Ford Endura.
I was. So the Endura is quite an interesting big car because it's, by all reports, and based on my experience, a really good thing. It's big and comfy and diesel powered, but because it's a large SUV that's not a seven seater, and it's also a brand name that people haven't really heard of in Australia, it's not found nearly as many fans as I think Ford potentially hoped it would. But I've been talking to some family friends who are in Geelong about their new car because they want to replace a Territory. And they want a large SUV with a lot of boot space. They want it to be able to tow. They want it to be all-wheel drive. And they want something that's comfortable on the highway. And I suggested a couple of cars to them, a Santa Fe and a Sorento, but the downball weight isn't heavy enough on those cars. And they're seven-seaters, which isn't quite right. Turns out the car that is absolutely perfect for them, they're the unicorns the Endura was designed for. So I don't know what they think of it yet. They're driving one this afternoon, I think. They're in regional Victoria where you can still go to a dealer. But, it was a light bulb moment that one of our commenters actually gave me the hint for. He commented on one of our stories and said, the Endura is really quite cheap on car sales at the moment for X-Demos. And I thought, that's perfect. These are the people Ford designed it for exactly.
I actually commend you, Scully, because I think that's what Ford Australia wanted people to do, get out of Territories and into Enduras. And I don't know how many of the people who actually have bought Enduras over the last couple of years have done what you've recommended to your friends, but like that's a pretty logical step up, I guess.
It'll be interesting to see what they think of it, having had a drive. I'm very much, yeah, very much excited to hear what they say when they text this afternoon to say how the test drive went, because, yeah, my memory of it, and I drove it a little while ago, is that it's just big and comfortable and nice, for want of better words than that, which yes. kind of suits what they want. So, yeah, hopefully that's the car for them.
Do they plan to do any off-road stuff in it?
Not really, no. Apparently they drive occasionally on some very mild tracks to get to campsites, but given they could do it in the Territory comfortably, I know the Territory is a little bit more capable off-road than the Endura. The Endura should be able to do everything they want of it and more.
All right, shall we get stuck into car news? Here we go. And we'll start off car news with you first, Scully. The 2021 Land Rover Defender is pretty much brand new and it's already getting updates.
It's an interesting one, this, because the Defender touched down, I think we spoke about it on the podcast about a month ago, and the first batch of cars is finally finding its way to owners, and already Land Rover globally and in Australia has announced that the four-cylinder diesels are gone, they're not going to stick around, and they've been replaced by three different versions of Jaguar Land Rover's inline six Ingenium diesel. Although they're slightly more expensive for 2021, the new diesel engines, especially the top-end diesel, which has 220 kilowatts of power and 650 newton meters of torque, they pump out a bit more power and torque, but they also promise to be similarly efficient to the four-cylinder engines in the car that arrived in Australia first. Yeah, they seem like a fairly significant upgrade, which if you haven't yet bought a Defender and you're looking at doing it, is great news. But if you've already laid down your money and have a four-cylinder diesel Defender coming, I think might make you a little bit annoyed. I know I would be a little bit annoyed if I'd found out that I'd paid, you know, between $70,000 and $100,000 for a car and then it's going to be replaced by one with a better engine months after it arrived. But that's just me, I guess. Beyond that, we also know more about the Defender 90. So the smaller, shorty Defender, the two-door, which I think looks really cool. It's obviously a little bit stumpier and a little bit more squat than the big 110. It's going to be offered with an entry-level diesel you don't get in the 110 with 147 kilowatts of power and 500 newton meters of torque. And we also know pricing will start just below the 110. So it's $71,500 for the base P300 petrol, whereas the 110 is $3,000 more expensive at $74,500. I'm curious, guys, how would you react if you had bought a four-cylinder Defender and just after it arrived, Land Rover said a bigger, better one's coming and it's going to cost pretty much the same?
I want my money back. Not happy, yeah, Jan.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I guess because I was actually – I had to do a double take when I read your story because I read the outputs of the lower grade engines. And I was like, they're not six cylinders. Don't be ridiculous. And then I read it again and I was like, oh, they're all six cylinders now. So I guess it would be more down to a matter of taste because if they're – similar outputs and everything, it probably shouldn't make that much more of a difference. And I would think that the four-cylinder would be lighter at the front. So I don't know whether that would make any difference to performance. But I can understand, knowing how good a lot of six-cylinder diesel engines are these days, especially out of Europe and the UK, I think that I would understand disappointment.
All right, we're going to move on. We're going to talk to Tony Crawford a little bit later on about the Kia Sorento review. But for now, the 2021 Sorento FEV and Hybrid are set to come to Australia, J-Wo.
Yes, this is actually really exciting. And I think maybe people don't understand how big of a deal this might actually be because I think a couple of years ago when Toyota sort of brought hybrid to the masses and really focused on it on their mainstream products, it's shown just how much people in Australia are willing to take a chance on electrification, get fuel consumption and emissions down and whatever. But we haven't really seen any of the other mainstream manufacturers do that. So for Kia to announce that both the regular self-charging hybrid and plug-in hybrid versions of the Sorento will be coming here and also quite soon in the first half of next year is quite a big deal. We don't know anything about pricing yet, but I think we can logically guess that the plug-in hybrid will probably be just an option on the top spec model and cost around or just over $70,000, which makes it probably one of the, if not the most expensive Kia that's ever been available here. But I think what will be really interesting is the normal hybrid, because Toyota's obviously been doing very well in that space in a lot of other segments. And the new Kluger, as I'm sure we'll talk about with Crawf later, will be coming soon as well with hybrid power. So depending on how Kia price the normal hybrid will be very, I think, indicative of how successful it will be, because Toyota's built a lot of success on offering, you know, Camry, Corolla, RAV4 hybrids somewhere between $1,500 and $3,000 over the equivalent petrol model. And given the normal Sorento offers both front drive V6 petrol and then four-wheel drive four-cylinder diesel, it'll be interesting to see where the price falls in that. But from what I've seen of reviews out of other countries, the normal hybrid's actually quite economical. It can do about 5.5 litres per 100Ks, which for a big seven-seater SUV is very impressive on its own. And if they can offer it across the lineup, I think we could see them sell quite a lot. So I'm quite excited for this car. I don't know about you guys.
I'm really excited because it also means there's now more pressure on other brands to bring theirs. So Kia bringing it is a big step, and we also know that Ford will have an Escape plug-in hybrid. It's a little bit smaller. Mitsubishi's going to do another Outlander FEV. But the Sorento FEV means that Hyundai now really, really has extra impetus to get the plug-in hybrid Santa Fe, and it's already confirmed the hybrid Santa Fe is coming. So hopefully this segment keeps growing because, I mean, for one, more choice is always a good thing, and there are people who don't like diesel cars and who spend a lot of time in the city and prefer petrol, but also want the extra economy of a hybrid that are really well served by these big hybrid SUVs. But also, even beyond that, I mean, giving Australian buyers the best possible range of options can only be a good thing. So, yeah, I quite like the idea that Kia doing it is going to be the kick in the bum that a lot of other car makers need to finally, you know, get the case across the line with head office and to show that this is the direction the market's going. And if you want to keep up, you need a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid.
And even internally, I guess, with Hyundai and Kia on their own, they've been a bit reluctant to bring a lot of their electrified options over. So hopefully if the buying public respond well to this, then it should spell a good indication of what's to come from, you know, next generation Sportage and Tucson, for example, or the next, you know, new Serato or things like that, and hopefully trickle down into their lower cars.
All right, we're going to move on to the next story now. Maserati is back in the supercar game. This week it's unveiled its mid-engined supercar, the MC20, and I don't know about you guys, but I think it's an absolute stunner. It was developed in just 2 years, with deliveries beginning worldwide next year for the coupe and the convertible and electric versions following in 2022. So powering this car at launch is a 3-litre twin-turbo V6 rated at 463 kilowatts at 7,500 RPM and 730 newton metres of torque between 3,000 and 5,500 RPM, paired with an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission, sending power to the rear wheels. Details on the electric drivetrain are yet to be announced. There is a lot of carbon fibre on this car, so it helps its overall weight of just 1,500 kilograms. 0 to 100 kilometres in just under 2.9 seconds, hitting 200 k's within 8.8 seconds, and its top speed is over 325 kilometres per hour. Orders are being placed now, even though production won't start till later this year. We've got no wording on pricing yet. But Automotive News understands the MC20 will be priced to compete against the Lamborghini Huracan and the Ferrari F8 Tributo. What do you guys reckon of this thing?
I'm a little concerned, actually.
Why is that?
Because I really, 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 really want it to be good, because Maserati is such an evocative brand and more competition in any part of the market is good, but especially at that top end. We've seen what McLaren's done to force Ferrari to lift its game. But I just worry that maybe the MC20 will fall into the same sort of basket as the Alfa 4C. I know they were competing in different segments, but inside the MC20 looks quite pared back compared to some of the other supercars out there. It's got a smaller displacement, lower cylinder count engine than some of its rivals, and it looks quite simple. I really like how pure the sides are, but the front end is not quite right to me. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. And I think when we see it in person, a lot more of it will make sense. But I'm just a little bit scared that people will look and go, well, it looks good, but it's not a Ferrari and it's not a V8, and maybe I'll just get a Ferrari or a V8. Or, I mean, that Huracan V10 just sounds incredible. That's reason enough to buy that car. So I just hope it's as good as we want it to be, and I'm kind of scared that it won't be.
Fair enough. What do you reckon, Joe?
I kind of have mixed feelings about it too, and this is something that I've kind of felt with some of Ferrari's latest cars as well, is that they're starting to look a little bit generic. And, like, it's, don't get me wrong, objectively, it is a beautiful car. The outside is beautiful, the shape, the lines and everything is gorgeous. The interior looks really nice. The steering wheel looks like it's out of an Alfa Romeo, but I'll let that go. And the specs are very, very impressive. I think it'll be a matter of where they place it in terms of pricing stuff will be very, very important, because I think a lot of people, once they get to a certain point in the market, they're very brand loyal. So, for example, if it's somewhere in the vicinity of $500,000 to $600,000, just as a throwaway guess, like Scott said before, like, you know, people might just go, well, I might as well get a Ferrari, or I might as well get a Lamborghini or whatever. And I think that it sort of lacks the some sort of wow factor that makes it very, very unique to Maserati. But everything looks awesome. It's a very impressive looking car. The specs look really cool. I think it's beautiful. But, yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of like... And also the name kind of sounds like a Mariah Carey album, but I'll leave that for another day.
Oh, of course. You had to get that in there. And lastly, Scully, look out, Tesla Model S, the Lucid Air has been detailed.
The Lucid Air has been detailed and it looks fantastic. So This company, there's a lot of startups coming for Tesla at the moment. They're obviously gunning for the electric market leader. And if you are going to be a startup, there's no point starting up now to build internal combustion family cars, because realistically it's much harder to do in terms of sourcing engines and all that sort of thing, whereas you can really lean on Silicon Valley and the world's tech talent to build an electric car. But also, if you're a startup, you need to be sexy. And at the moment in that world, electric cars are sexy in the way that Tesla is doing crazy numbers on its stock price, even though it fell a little bit this week. So Lucid is actually being led by Peter Rawlinson, who is the man who led development of the Tesla Model S. And I'm going to hit you with some specs here because they are seriously impressive. The base Air is going to cost the equivalent of $110,000 Australian dollars. The second from the bottom, which is called the Touring, is going to cost $130,000 and has a range of 653 kilometers and 462 kilowatts of power. And the range topper, which is called the Dream Edition, it's going to be priced at about $220,000, which is not cheap, but 748 kilometers of all-electric range and 805 kilowatts. It'll do 0 to 100 in 2.5 seconds.
That's insane.
So crazy, crazy numbers. I think even more impressive than that is Lucid hasn't gone outside to get a lot of the important electrical stuff done. It actually started as a company that built batteries and electric motors for Chinese electric buses, which is the opposite of exciting or sexy. But it means that the company has been able to develop its own motor inverter system that is really, really small and efficient. And that means that even though it's as small or smaller than a Tesla Model S or a Porsche Taycan outside, the interior, based on reports I've read from overseas, has space for four people who are over 6 foot. There's a massive front boot or frunk or whatever you want to call it, because the motors don't eat into that space too much. So it really seems like Lucid has engineered this in a way that gives it control over what it wants to do, but also is quite thorough. I mean, obviously the proof will be in the driving, and there's no word on when this will be in Australia just yet. But of all the startups and the competitors to Tesla we've seen pop up, this does seem like one of the more credible ones. It's also backed by money from Saudi Arabia. So the idea of them going broke is less likely now that money's on board than maybe some other startups.
Yeah. Did Lucid detail charging times?
It did, and it's very fast. So The 900-volt architecture, which is an industry first, the Taycan has an 800-volt architecture, is good for 32 kilometers of range every minute, or 483 kilometers in just 20 minutes on the fastest 350 kilowatt chargers. So the Taycan will do 100 kilometers in 5 minutes, which would put it on about 400 kilometers in 20 minutes. And Tesla's V3 supercharger, depending on where you are and what the situation is like, has been filmed doing about 160 kilometers in 7 minutes. I'm not a great mathematician, but that's about 480 kilometers in 21 minutes. So it's right on the cutting edge with that charge tech, provided that you have access to a really fast charger. It's another one of those things, though, that we really have to see working in the real world, because these peak charge times are great, but the challenge with charging anything is not just how fast you can do it in ideal conditions, it's how fast you can get the battery to the right temperature, how fast the charger can actually handle these things, and then how the battery cools and heats itself afterwards. So, yeah, there's a lot of really promising things on paper for this car, but the reality is we're going to have to wait to see it in person in the real world to know if it is the real deal.
Absolutely. That wraps up this week's car news. You can hit the car news link at carexpert.com.au to get more of your news fix. Our feature guest this week is Stuart Parnaby, the National Marketing Manager at Genesis Motors Australia. And we've got him on Car Expert just to talk all things Genesis, really. Welcome, Stuart, and thanks for your time. Scully, I understand you want to start off with the first question.
Stuart, I think to start with, it's probably good to get an idea of what the National Marketing Manager for Genesis actually does in Australia.
Look, Genesis is obviously a new brand, so a marketing manager of a new brand does a lot. For those who know marketing, there's many fields within it. Marketing's kind of like being a doctor. There's a doctor and then there's all sorts of specialists, but in our world, I do everything. I do social, I plan the brand direction, I do our media, I do our creative. I mean, obviously with the help of a lot of great agencies and whatnot, but my job's trying to tell the Genesis story, basically. So that's it in a nutshell, without turning into too much of a marketing geek.
So Genesis is obviously, like you've said, very young in Australia. What is the story you're actually trying to say to Australian luxury buyers? Because you're up against some pretty stiff competition.
Give us a chance. We'll probably be it in a nutshell. We are young in Australia, and sometimes it's so easy to tell the story face to face, and sometimes I sort of wish I was in the sales team on the front lines, because, you know, if I can get 3 minutes of someone's time, I can normally tell them a pretty nice story. But trying to do that in the media landscape is tough when you have, you know, a digital banner taking up 1 second in the side of the screen, or you know, an ad or whatever it may be. But many people don't realize how long the Genesis product has existed. I mean, it was North American Car of the Year, I think over a decade ago. Again, being a marketing geek, check out the ad Hyundai Not Sunday on YouTube, and you'll see one of my favorite bits of creative ever with a bit of Jeff Bridges as a voiceover. Genesis as a product was kicking goals for a really long time. And then Hyundai obviously broke it out and said we want it to be its own brand. You know, we tell people that, you know, Lexus Toyota is Genesis Hyundai, and that, you know, premium brands can come off mass brands all the time. It is hard to challenge the competition, but, you know, a lot of experts will tell us that we make a great product. And I guess the message is, what are you actually buying? Are you buying the product, or are you buying the image and the brand behind it? And I'm not saying that doesn't have value, but if the product's good enough, why don't you come see if you fall in love with it? And if you do, be brave and buy it.
Stuart, on that topic, who exactly is the Genesis brand trying to target specific to our market? Are you trying to get existing luxury buyers of perhaps German brands? Are you trying to attract people from, say, high-end Hyundai and Kia models? Is there a clear-cut vision of, like, who you're trying to attract into Genesis showrooms?
There is. I think it'd be remiss of me to not acknowledge the obvious, and that is when you're in the premium car market, you're trying to target people that have the money to buy a premium car. That sort of goes without saying. So in doing so, you inherently line up against the big Germans, against Lexus, you know, against your Volvos and your Jags and all of those. But what many people don't realize is that they target the mass as well. A lot of the luxury market is purchased by first-time luxury buyers. So you kind of need to appeal to any and all. Yes, I do want someone who is in a BMW to come across and buy a Genesis, but yes, I also want that person who is coming out of a high-end, you know, Toyota, Kluger, Hyundai, Santa Fe, that's spending $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on a vehicle already to come across and say, well, what, if I'm stepping up for, because I've gotten a pay rise, or I'm willing to spend more on the family, or whatever it may be, it's a personal treat. Maybe I'm an empty nester and I've got a bit more disposable income. Yeah, buy a Genesis. So without sounding a bit naive, once they pass the can they buy it test, then we want to appeal to everyone. And I think our parent brand has always tried to do that as well.
Stuart, there's probably two parts to this, but I suppose the first is, how difficult has it been with a lineup of only sedans to actually get people's attention in a market that is just dominated by SUVs at the moment?
you're making me smile in a way you can't possibly understand. Look, it's quite difficult. Sedans are not the flavour of the month in the Australian car market. People feel like they get more value for money from an SUV because it was always the more expensive car, the larger car. There's this perception of space and affluence and that you've made it. So, look, it is difficult. But the one thing I'll say is that They are pretty cracking vehicles that we put to market. That G70 in particular, I love. Gets some great reviews. Over in the States, JD Power just announced it as the best car in the compact premium class for 2020. So it's tough to only tell the world about sedans, but they're sedans that do stack up. So in that regard, it's a bit of a joy at the same time.
I think part two of that is obviously you finally have SUVs coming. So we'll see the first Genesis SUV in Australia later this year. Can you talk us through a little bit about the pricing of that car? Because it's right in line with the Volkswagen Touareg, and it undercuts the bottom end BMW X5. It seems like you've very deliberately picked a gap in the market there.
Well, it's probably a good segue into sort of the Genesis pricing model, which is Genesis is trying to come to market with a what we call a one price model or a no haggle policy. Many of those competitors that you sort of say, X5 and Q7 and whatnot, they put a price tag on, and then you walk into the dealership and get given 10, 15, 20% off, and then you think you've gotten a great deal. But if five people are at a barbecue and they all bought a $120,000 car for $100,000, did they all get a good deal, or is that actually a $100,000 car? If that's the price that it goes for every day, then it's a little bit of marketing tricks there. So, look, our car is priced at the value we think someone should drive it away. That's the Genesis model we're trying to get to. It's difficult to do because, like I said, people want to feel like they walked out with a deal. But it's a way I think all car companies would love to go in the future. And that's where we're going. So we think that car is priced at what a consumer should pay for it, I suppose, would say is the way we've put it.
Stuart, on the topic of GV80, and I guess I can relate this also to the new G80, with these new products coming, how much interest have you seen from the buying public for these new models, given, for example, the old G80 was getting on a bit and the G70's been a bit of a quiet seller in relative terms? Have the new models that are coming at the end of this year received a bit of interest?
Yes, basically. New G80, not as much. We haven't made a lot of noise about that particular vehicle from a marketing point of view, and that's because it's replacing a vehicle. There's certain reasons why we make those choices. But GV80, we have people walk into the head office and ask us questions about it. That people are really, really excited about this product. Overseas, it's got waiting lists. We wanted to be launching it earlier in the year. People are contacting us on social media daily. When's it coming? When can I drive one? They're absolutely excited. I think we're probably going to disappoint a few people that they might have to wait a month or two when they finally pull the trigger on the purchase, because, yeah, there is some demand. I'm not saying we're going to sell the volume of our German competitors, but I think we're going to surprise the public with how many people want to be in that car. It is spectacular.
On the sales model and the fact you're expecting more demand for the GV80, are you going to have enough showroom space? I know Genesis doesn't call them showrooms, but is it going to be easy enough for people to actually find the GV80 and come and take it for a drive, given you don't have the dealer footprint of someone like a BMW or an Audi?
You know, can I say I hope not? Not from a customer point of view, but hey, too many customers, a marketing manager would be happy. But I think that's probably the time to bring up, you know, what Genesis does, which is people ask why we don't have a lot of dealerships everywhere, and that's because their expectation is that they have to turn up to one in order to purchase or experience the vehicle. But the Genesis model is you contact us and we bring the vehicle to you. So all those staff that are standing in that studio, as we call it, in Pitt Street, or our new location in Parramatta, or our upcoming location in Macquarie Park, and the footprint's ever expanding, I'll reserve a few of the places that we're potentially going interstate, but they're there so that they can jump in a car and drive it to your house. We want you to test drive on your streets. We want you to test drive in and around your work or your place of living, so that you experience the car that you're going to drive every day where you're going to drive it every day. Absolutely. And we do that within a fairly large radius. We do that within 70 kilometres of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. We do have plans to extend to the other capital cities, and apologise to those ones that eagerly are awaiting our arrival. But why should you have to leave your home to come to us to experience something? You're an important customer. We bring it to you.
Stuart, I really like this, you know, customer-focused tailor model that Genesis has. And something that I've noticed, especially with your upcoming products, is that there really is a very big range of standard or, you know, available color and trim options that you can choose. Like, I've played around with the configurator. I've made a GV80 that's literally green inside and out, which is, you know, something that I really like. But given that we're seeing a lot of companies, both in the mainstream and premium segments, start to reduce some of their standard personalization offerings, how important is it for Genesis to continue offering such a wide array of options?
It's super important. I mean, our philosophy in Australia for the whole group has been give people access to the things that they deserve access to. Don't lock it away on a trim level that only a few can afford and whatever else. Also, we don't like complexity. We don't like the fact that, you know, to get that with this, you need that engine type, but that color's only locked to that. And then, you know, if you want that feature, you can't have that engine. And sometimes you need a sort of a university degree in some of our competitor brands to understand, you know, which features on which model. For us, we're trying to really streamline what we offer. We say these are all the features that you deserve if you're going to pay that much for a vehicle. And if you want a little bit more, this is the additional set of features that we can give you. So it's quite easy for a customer to walk in and understand. I suppose convenience is not really the right word. Simplicity is probably the best word that we're trying to achieve. We're just trying to make it so that our customers get it and they feel like they have the power. You know, back to the dealer model, that's what we're trying to give back to customers. We're trying to say you don't need to be an expert negotiator. You don't need to be an expert in what feature should be worth what amount. We're trying to say, do you love this car? And if you do, why don't you buy it?
So on that theme then, when Genesis does eventually launch some of the more niche cars we've seen testing, like the G70 Shooting Brake, for example, does that mean that you're going to have your hand up to bring them to Australia?
Look, I need to keep my cards a little bit close to my chest on what sort of future plans were, but I'll say there's a lot of rumour and a lot of spy shot and a lot of someone at head office is not doing a good job of keeping secrets. So, look, we want to bring everything we can to this market, and Genesis has big dreams. Genesis has some amazing products. Everyone that works for a car company that gets to see the sort of 1, 2, 3 year roadmap is always so excited about what's coming. I mean, you gents would know how long it takes to bring a car to market. So we're very excited to bring as much of the lineup to Australia as we can. And I think you kind of wish you could tell more of the story, because if people knew where the brand was going, sometimes we get asked the question, are we the next Infiniti? And I simply say, not from the confidential documents I've seen. We're not going anywhere anytime soon. So, yeah, some great product coming down the line.
While we're talking future product, and again, I know there's only so much you can say about this, but to wrap this up, what about electric vehicles? How do you see them fitting into the Genesis lineup in Australia in the future? Because obviously it's a direction that a lot more luxury brands are going and something that more buyers are starting to demand.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing from you guys. What do you think about electric premium vehicles? Do you think they've got a place here?
I personally do. I know they're not for everyone and they're expensive at the moment, but if you have the money and the desire to do something that is probably better for the environment than, you know, a big diesel engine or a big petrol engine, then having the option of something smooth, quiet and quick like an electric SUV is only a good thing.
Well, look, if an expert like yourself is keen on seeing the more premiums go that way, I'll say that I think that our brand is smart enough to go in a very similar direction to what the experts think. So it's going to be important we go in that space. I think it's been said publicly by one of our former heads of the brand how important it is for Genesis to go into that electric space. Again, there's probably a few leaked bits and pieces all over the internet about that. So, you know, me trying to be coy is probably a bit of a waste of time. Genesis is going to continue to lead in every way possible from a product point of view. And the premium space, like you said, is going that way. And if we want to lead in our product and what we put out, we need to go that way as well. And I think if you listen to my earlier answer of how excited I am about the future and read between the lines, then I'm sure everyone can sort of make their own assumptions about where we're going.
Stuart, thank you for taking the time to chat to us. I think you even managed to sneak in some market research there. We really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate the time, guys. And look, thanks for having me. And like I said, if anyone's out there, do yourself a favour and try a Genesis. And if you fall in love, follow your heart.
The 2020 Kia Sorento. It's new. It's impressive. And Tony Crawford gives it two big thumbs up. Hello, Tony.
I do, Mandy. Hello. And how are you all?
We're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about it. Do you reckon it'll give the Touareg and the CX-9 a run for its money?
I reckon. I definitely reckon so. Yes, it has two thumbs up. Would have had three. But we'll get to that in a minute. But it's been around a long – I remember the original Sorento, and it was quite a nasty-looking thing, really. It wasn't a handsome beast like this new one is. I won't say beast, but it's a very handsome vehicle that if it had another badge on it from Europe, you'd probably think, great, that looks great too. But it has a Kia badge on it, and the one we drove and the only one I tested was the top-of-the-range GT line, and that goes for $64,990 drive away. It might be out a couple of hundred bucks there, but it's around there anyway, drive away. Interestingly, the difference between the MSRP and the drive away are very close. It's like $1,000 or less, which is really interesting because there used to be quite a gap between those two prices, but Kia and other manufacturers obviously have worked that out, and we're getting close to sort of only talking about drive away because at the end of the day, what use is a price without being drive away anyway, I suppose. Mm.
So do you reckon the price on that Sorento is good value for money? What sort of kit do you get in it?
I do. 64, okay. Yeah. You get everything. I don't – anything you could say it will have, including some of the most advanced safety kit in the world right now. It's just got everything. There's nothing – you couldn't list what this vehicle has. It'd be pages long. And that's everything from extraordinarily comfortable Napa leather seats right throughout the three rows. Don't forget Kia Sorento is a seven-seater and so heated outer rear seats in the second row as well. But even the cup holders in the third row are like proper cup holders with those sort of things that sort of grab onto the cup down below rather than just being a hole in the plastic. All this sort of detail is there. The alloy the actual real alloy accents throughout the car, the brushed alloy. They're really tasteful and no less than what you'd find in an Audi, which is generally considered the benchmark in sort of accoutrements of cabins, of auto cabins. And this has got all that and more, in fact. And I just think it's a bargain. Mind you, we haven't driven any of the other cheaper trim levels, so it'll be interesting to see what they're like as well.
Croft, my parents actually drive a previous generation Sorento, not the last generation, but the generation before. And actually, part of the reason they bought one is because we watched Elbors' review a few years ago. Given your knowledge of all the different generations of Sorento over the last 15, 20 years, how would you say that the new one really represents how Kia's kind of stepped up from being a budget brand into like a mainstream, if not semi-premium mark at the top level of its range?
Yeah, totally. It's interesting you say that word semi-premium. That's a word we often use associated with Korean or Japanese cars as opposed to, you know, German or British so-called luxury cars. I think this is a proper luxury car. You know, the leather dash and the stitching right through. And, I mean, it just is a proper luxury car. And that goes... Probably the only thing that isn't luxurious that I caught the car out on was low speed ride over. It really picks up a lot of indentations in the road, which I thought, you know, it kind of spoiled the entire package for me. I don't know if a lot of other journos picked up on that and actually spoke about that. Maybe they were too overawed with, you know, the luxury cabin and the engine is an exceptionally good diesel engine. But back to that ride, it has a decent ride over sort of big speed bumps and it's very good over gravel. I specifically sought out some really crappy country road style B roads that I've got quite close to me. And you don't feel the tires over those. It's just really plush. But low speed ride, which is, you know, where most of these vehicles are going to end up, let's face it, in Urbanville, it's quite sharp. And I'm reckoning that's because it has a tow weight, brake tow weight of 2,000 kilos. Maybe they've had to beef up the rear springs. And don't forget, it's a seven-seater, so... if you had seven people in there and you were towing something, box trailer or whatever, then probably the rear springs will need to be strengthened. But why not offer adaptive air suspension or adaptive dampers at least on the GT line, or at least as an option for people that may think it's a bit harsh on their test drive, you know. So that's my only – I don't have any other faults with it. The engine is fantastic. There's very low – turbo lag from very low in the rev range, which is unusual for a 2.2 diesel. They normally suffer from lag, but this is definitely – they've done some work on this engine, and it's 19.5 kilos lighter than the previous steel or a steel block. This is an alloy block now, so that could be something to do with it. It also has some clever variable valve technology that goes one step further. I don't really understand the complete machinations of that, but I do know it brings more low down punch, if you like.
Croft, we've got the diesel, we've got the petrol coming, but the ones that I'm really excited for are the plug-in hybrid and the hybrid. Do you think that the Sorento is going to be good enough as a hybrid to really make the Toyota Kluger nervous? Because we know we're getting the next-gen Kluger in hybrid as well.
Yeah, in a way, yes. I mean, everything from the infotainment. So you've got a giant 12.3-inch digital instrument display, which I'd say is every bit as good, if not better, than some of the Germans in its color and clarity. And then you've got this 10.25-inch infotainment screen, which is just excellent. And it sort of looks like it's definitely a nod to Benz, but I think it's actually better integrated than Benz. The Benz dual screen isn't really integrated, as we know. It's just sort of stuck on the top of the sort of, you know, the medium view line on the dash. But this one's actually integrated properly. And I can't wait for you guys to get in it and just see what I'm talking about, because it's quite special. And they've really thought about every detail of this vehicle, even the air vents. you sort of get two goes at the air vent. The top vent you can alter, and then the bottom, it's sort of split into two sections, again with this beautiful alloy framing. Just all stuff like that that you would normally find on, you know, $100,000 German car. It's all right here for 64 drive away, and, you know, you've got a lot of space, let's face it. Although, interestingly, you might see this car as a much bigger vehicle than the previous vehicle, but in actual fact, it's just 10 millimeters longer and a bit wider. But they're very clever with the spatial packaging in this vehicle. Just behind the second row, I think there's 616 liters of cargo space. That's a lot. And then if you fold it all down, second and third row, I think there's 2,000 plus liters of cargo space. So it's an enormous amount of room. And, of course, rear seat legroom is limo style.
All right. Well, you can read the rest of the review of the Sorento GT Line diesel up at carexpert.com.au, where Tony has given it a rating of 8.3. Tony Crawford, thanks for your time.
Is that it for me?
Yeah, I can't, that's it for you, mate.
Nothing more to talk about.
That's it.
Thank you.
It's hard to believe our co-founder, Albor's fella, can be seen driving around in a base model car. But last week he was, never mind that it was a Porsche. But anyway, he joins us to talk about his time behind the wheel of the 2021 Porsche Macan. Hello, Albor.
I feel like I have a bad reputation for this. It's I do. I also drove a Hyundai Tucson recently. It is true. It did happen.
Really?
So,
was that the base model one as well?
It was a mid-spec Tucson. But, you know, like, it's all right. But, yes, look, I did actually spent a week in this Porsche Macan, and it's funny you call it a base model, because when I saw that as well, that it was a base model I was picking up, I almost was like, oh god, don't know if I want to drive this. And by the end of the week, I actually came to the realization that I actually think it would be my pick of the bunch in the whole range.
Really? Wow.
Just because
did it actually feel spacey?
It felt, look, it didn't feel as quick as you'd expect from a Porsche. I mean, it's got that sort of Volkswagen Group engine with only 185 kilowatts. So, you know, it's 185 kilowatts for a Porsche is these days not exactly what you'd call powerful. But, hey, it did the job and it looked great. And I think from the outside, like, you can't tell. You just can't tell at all. And if you're using this thing to drive around the city and take the kids to school, like, I don't get what the point of spending an extra 20 grand would be to get a bigger engine and a little bit more, you know, spec. But, you know, 6.7 to 100, it's pretty good. And if you tick the option for sports chrono, it actually goes down to 6.5. I really think that should be standard. But anyway, it's a Porsche. So $16,000 less than the Macan S just to miss out on the 3-liter engine. I think that's 16 grand well saved, in my opinion.
Okay. So the Macan's been around since 2014. It's had a few updates between now and then. Do you think it's starting to age?
Yes, I do. And I only say that because of the car park that's out there of Macans. There's so many of them driving around that you kind of, you know, when it first came out, I remember when you saw one on the road, you really went, wow, that actually looks great. It still looks great, but I feel like it's probably in need of an overhaul at some point in the near future. But look, it's, you know, it's still, in my opinion, the best sort of car in its class. You sort of got to compare it against maybe a Velar. The Velar is a little bit bigger, but in terms of a driver's car, it's really hard to beat the Macan. It just drives really, really nicely.
Did you get a chance to take it around some twisties?
Yeah, my usual test track around sort of Mount Glorious here in Brisbane, had a good run through that. It, again, like, you know, even with 185 kilowatts, I think you would sort of murder a fair few hot hatches that probably weigh less and have got more power. So it's a lot going for this car. And, it's truly, for me, the best sort of medium, small, premium SUV you can buy right now, still.
Boz, you mentioned options. Were there any fitted to our test car that you absolutely have to have? And if you were buying one, like, how much extra money are you spending on top of the list price to make it the car you want?
It is a Porsche. So, yes, to answer your question, you need to spec up a few things. You know, I think my car had, like, Macan wheels for $6,000. It had a panoramic roof for $3,000. It had a whole bunch of stuff in it that you probably don't really need, but it's nice to have. The thing that really annoyed me was the $2,000 to get the safety pack, so you can get the autonomous emergency braking and a few other things. I mean, that is just ridiculous. That should be standard on a Porsche. Safety should never be an option, and I don't know why that's the case here. They got a lot of flack for it when it first came out. But I guess the idea is you give people a choice that they can have it or they don't have to have it. But I think most people don't realize what it is. Unless you've experienced AEB and realize how beneficial it is, you're not going to pay $2,000 for something you don't even see. So that's where the car company has to go. We know what's better here, and we're going to make that decision for you. But they want to keep the price down, so they've put the onus on the buyer. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but I hope anyone listening that's looking at a Macan will certainly tick that $2,000 option, because any little accident you're going to have is going to cost you more than that.
You mentioned, obviously, you would put a few more options on it, but were there any other cons that you found with the car during the week?
I mean, not having keyless entry as a standard, going back to harassing you about options. But other than that, I think you can now make the argument that the interior is feeling a little bit dated. But then again, that's only when you comparison to getting into something like a new Mercedes or something like that. But it's not like it doesn't do the job, and the screen is really good and Apple CarPlay works really nicely. So I don't know. It's actually quite hard to criticize. The rear seats are definitely made for two. You wouldn't want to fit three back there for long periods of time. It actually has USB-C ports, which I love. For me, is a sign of a modern car. It's not stuck with those old USB ports, USB A and B ports. So I don't know. It was actually quite hard for me to criticize it, to be honest. I actually went into the week thinking it was going to be an absolute piece of crap and it's slow and all that sort of stuff. And I came out of it thinking it's actually the only one I'd buy now for the money.
Why would you say that?
Because, like I was saying before, I think it's not worth spending the extra $16,000 just to get a slightly bigger engine, or even more money, like $150,000 to get the turbo. So this thing starts at about 85. So you're thinking roughly about 90 on road, and if you take a few boxes, so say about 100 on road. So to spend an extra $50,000 for a turbo Macan, I don't see the point. To be honest, I don't understand what you will get from that. Unless you really, really want to go really fast all the time. But that's not the point of this car, so I'm not sure.
Given $150,000 to spend on a performance or a luxury SUV, what would you buy instead then? Because the Macan has always been a favorite in that segment, even as you get the price up.
At the 150s, honestly, I'd be looking at a Velar SV Autobiography or a F-Pace SVR. A couple of things like that are sort of around that price point. I wouldn't mind a GLC 63. I think that's a pretty cool car. The looks don't work for me, so I'm not really sure. But other than that, it's really hard to go past the Macan. And a lot of people do end up with it. The X3 and all its different variants are also pretty good, but there's kind of something to be said about owning a Porsche. So, I don't think there is a huge amount of Porsche tax here. Obviously, the options, I mean, there's none of the other Germans have safety as an option. Like, they all have the AEB stuff standard. But to not have it on the Macan, for me, that's the sort of stuff that I think they really need to address, because people will eventually wisen up to it.
Elbors, clearly you've enjoyed your time with the four-cylinder Macan, and I'm sure you've driven all the other variants as well. The next generation Macan is meant to be all electric. Do you feel that the fact that you can get that sort of purish drive experience from a Macan with all the different engine choices and make it very sports car like is going to be lost by turning the next one into an EV?
Look, I know they've said that a few times. I'll believe it when I see it. And also, I believe that they may even run this in a current gen continuously while the new one comes out as well. I'm not sure. Again, you're right. I've heard the same thing, but that seems like a pretty bold move for one of their best sellers. So I'll believe it when I see it. But yes, you're right. I think taking all the engine choices out and then giving us the option of range in the electric car as the differentiator probably, I don't know if you'd pay an extra $50,000 to have an extra 100 kilometers of range. I think people will start thinking about those quite differently. So, and also, the batteries won't cost anywhere near as much. So I guess it'll be a choice of having rear-wheel drive, all-wheel drive, better motors and things like that. But I don't know, man. I'm, you know my views on electric cars. I'm still to be convinced. So I'm not Paul Merrick. So maybe in time.
You can read Alvor's review now up at carexpert.com.au and let us know what you think in the comments as well. And that brings an end to this week's podcast. Sadly, all our Melbourne journos still can't drive cars yet, Scully, but all the rest in interstate can.
They can, and there's some interesting stuff coming through the garage. We've got a Merc GLE 53 Coupe. J-Wo, you drove the wagon version of that and came away impressed, but not quite as impressed as I think maybe you'd hoped is probably a fair way to put it.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way.
We've also got the Audi RS3 sedan and the Peugeot 3008 GT line in New South Wales. The guys in Queensland have got the new Volkswagen Golf GTI TCR, which I'm very excited to hear about. It's the racier sort of farewell special for the GTI. As a GTI owner, J-Wo, would you consider upgrading?
So this is a thing I actually – they announced pricing ages ago, and so I remember there was a period where I was really considering – you know, whether I wanted to get one of the last editions of the GTI and R, because obviously you can get the R in green, and the TCR is really cool as well because you can get that awesome grey paint. I just don't know how I feel about the fact that the TCR for Australia is not the tune that Europe gets. So Europe gets the tune with more torque, but the 7-speed transmission, but they've got like all the emission stuff in there. So they brought a lower output one here, and I just don't know if it's as much of an upgrade as I'd like, but I'm very interested to see what it's like.
Okay, so if you have any feedback for this week's podcast, please shoot us an email, or even the Founders Podcast if you're following that one too with Paul Albors and Tony. The email address is podcast@carexpert.com.au. Scott Colley and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.